on Commerce. Thanks for everyone to be here. We have two bills that are up for a public possible hearing and work session. Those are Senate Bill 119 and Senate Bill 172. We also have an informational meeting that the Bureau of Labor and Industry is going to be giving us an overview. And because I'm missing some committee members, I think we're going to flip-flop the agenda and ask for the representatives from Boley to come forward to give us their kind and wise words.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we'll see if we can live up to that intro and having kind and wise words. Just to give you a little bit of an overview, as my staff decides who doesn't want to sit next to me because of the cold I have.
Commissioner Gardner, you might want to move one more over, and that's pretty far away from the microphone.
I'm not sure if I can do that, Mr. Chair.
I'm far away.
Actually,
I'll help out here.
I appreciate it. One of the things that we wanted to point out to you just a little bit today is one of the improvements we've attempted to make since last biennium is our little booklet that we sent out to, I believe we've got it out to almost all of the legislative offices now, which can help with a lot of things, including the key contacts and organizational charts of the Bureau and other information. If you turn to policy overview, one of the things the Bureau of Labor and Industries is actually, this summer it'll be 101 years old. One little known fact is I'm only the eighth commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which just means some of them hung around a long time. But we did just have our 100-year anniversary last year. And There's three basic divisions to the Bureau: the Civil Rights Division, the Apprenticeship Division, and the Wage and Hour Division. We also license farm labor camps. We do the prevailing wage survey. And one of the greatest things about the Bureau, probably that most people aren't even aware of, is the Technical Assistance Unit. Which the Technical Assistance Unit for Employers was started. Basically, our philosophy on that one was simply that the best way to take care of problems is to prevent them in the first place from ever happening. And we answer over 25,000 telephone calls every year from employers. We actually have a number of handbooks, which Annette has there with you, and we're actually in republication of new handbooks on those. The three that she has there, we have a copy for the committee, and also we have new handbooks coming out.
So, Mr. Commissioner, I just want to make sure, since these are going to the committee administrator gets to keep them, be the keeper of the record. She gets to carry them back up to her office, and I don't have to? Or do I carry those?
Mr. Chair, that's strictly up to you. That is at the pleasure of the chair. However, normally we would charge for those books, and those are free of service today. So,
how much money do you have in our bank account?
Actually, that is how we keep the technical assistance actually is totally self-supporting,
right,
through the seminars that we put on and the publications that we do sell. And those are also, most all, if not all of the information is also available on our website. Those three books on family leave law, policy writing, guidelines, and documents are all just new books that are coming out. The five additional books on wage and hour, civil rights, white-collar exemptions, and others are on their way out before the end of the year. Hopefully, one of them before a couple of months is over here. They also put on 132 Boley seminars in 2004, serving about 2,252 participants. Additionally, the team held 106 on-sites for employers, serving an estimated 3,600. So basically, technical assistance does seminars for somewhere between 5,000 to 6,000 managers and supervisors every year, and they are a great unit. At this point, I'd rather turn it over to Christy Hammond to explain the Wage and Hour Division.
Thanks. fine. I just wonder if Ms. Hammond wants to sit that close.
Actually, they've all been avoiding me out in the hall, Mr. Chair.
Well, you notice I walked past you, too.
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
Good afternoon, Chair Prozonsky and members of the committee. I'm Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And you have a tab in your notebooks labeled Wage and Hour Division, and I'm going to cover some of the material that is in your notebooks rather quickly. I just want to tell you a little bit about each of the programs that the Wage and Hour Division administers. We enforce several laws, including the minimum wage and overtime and working conditions provisions of Oregon law. So most people are familiar with the state minimum wage. We don't get a lot of claims for unpaid minimum wages, but the overtime provisions under the minimum wage law are an activity that we enforce, and we do get quite a few overtime wage claims. Also part of the minimum wage law are working conditions provisions, and those are things like rest and meal periods. We get quite a few complaints about failure to receive required rest and meal periods, so we enforce those provisions as well. We try to get compliance with the employer before assessing penalties, but we do have the ability to assess civil penalties for an employer's failure to provide rest and meal periods as required. A second wage claim law we enforce is known as the wage collection law, and it actually applies to wage claims that are more than minimum wage. So, for example, if an employer agrees to compensate an employee at the rate of $15 an hour, we can enforce that wage agreement as well. So that's under the wage collection law, which is different than the minimum wage law. Also under the wage collection law are provisions relating to final paychecks and unlawful deductions, and we have quite a few wage claims and complaints that we process under those provisions as well. We receive an average of about 3,500 wage claims annually. We have 8 compliance specialists statewide that handle our non-prevailing wage rate wage claims. Last year we collected a little over $1 million in unpaid back wages. The Wage Security Fund is also a program under the wage collection law, and that is a fund that is available to pay workers when their employers go out of business and are without assets to pay final wages due. We can pay the last 60 days of an employee's wages up to a maximum of $4,000. That fund is funded by a once a biennium diversion of the employment tax paid by employers. 0.03% of that tax is diverted into the Wage Security Fund, and that generates about $3 million annually to pay workers out of the fund. Last year we paid out over $1.8 million to 900 employees, so that fund's been in effect since 1995 and has paid out a lot of workers, paid out a lot of money to workers who otherwise wouldn't have received their last paychecks.
Ms. Hammond, can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
On that fund, based on what you said, if it brings in about $3 million a year and there's a payout of just over 1 point something, the remaining stays in the fund, I assume. Is there a cap to that fund as to, or does it just continue to accumulate for the future?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We only get that amount every eighth quarter in every biennium, so it has to last for 2 full years.
Okay.
There is not a cap, and in the legislature's search for other funds last session, they did remove $2 million from the fund of January of this year, which has left us with a very small balance at this point in time. In fact, we reported to the emergency board at one point we were afraid of running out of money. So we should be down to probably less than $75,000 or $50,000 by the time we get another infusion of dollars in May or June from the Employment Department.
Thanks for the clarification.
If there aren't any other questions about our wage collection program, we also enforce the child labor provisions under state law. That program consists of issuing employment certificates to employers who employ minors in this state. Every minor is required to apply for a certificate before employing minors, and part of that process entails listing the duties that the minors will be employed to perform. We review those duties to make sure they're in compliance with the law, and if so, issue the employment certificate to the employer. If there's a problem with the proposed duties, we get on the phone with the employer and try to help them provide acceptable duties so the minor can remain employed without being in violation of the law. We also investigate reports that we receive of violations to the child labor laws, and those include prohibited activities and things such as excessive work hours. So we enforce those laws as well. The prevailing wage rate law is a law that applies to public works projects in the state of Oregon. We enforce the wage rates that are required to be paid to workers on those public construction projects. We determine and publish the applicable wage rates twice a year based on an annual construction industry survey that is conducted by the Employment Department on contract with us. And we review the data that's received from the construction industry each year and determine the rates to be paid for the following year based on that survey. We also investigate complaints of violations under the prevailing wage rate law and collect unpaid wages. That program is funded by fees paid by contractors who have public works projects, and they're required to pay 0.1% of the contract price to the Bureau, no less than $100 and no more than a fee of $5,000. And that fund funds our enforcement and education program, as well as the conduct of the annual construction survey. We enforce the Farm Forest Labor Contractor Law, and that includes licensing approximately 250 Farm Forest Labor Contractors annually and conducting investigations of violations that come to our attention under the Farm Forest Labor Contractor Law. We also have a proactive program to conduct outreach and education to farm workers, agricultural employers, and farm labor contractors. And we have staff that speak, in addition to English, of course, Spanish and Russian, because a lot of the workers in the industry are Spanish-speaking. And then finally, we have a law called the Private Employment Agency Law. Up until 1997, we actually issued licenses to private employment agencies in the state. The licensing provisions were abolished by the legislature in 1997, and what is left are requirements that agencies must comply with if they collect a fee from applicants for employment. There are certain provisions that are required on the part of the agency. For example, they have to have a bona fide job order and comply with certain provisions in order to collect a fee from applicants. So that's a real quick overview of all the programs in the Wage and Hour Division. Any questions?
No. Well, I would like to have Amy Clare come up and give the Civil Rights Division overview.
And that's, Mr. Chair, under the Program Activities tab, it's the second cardstock.
Good afternoon, Senator Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Amy Clare, and I'm the Administrator of the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The mission of the Civil Rights Division is to enforce laws that grant job seekers and employees equal access to jobs, promotions, and a work environment free from discrimination and harassment. It's also to assure job protection when reporting work site safety violations, using family leave provisions, or the workers' compensation system, to provide protection for those seeking housing or the use of public facilities such as retail establishments, transportation, and sometimes places of worship, and to enforce laws that provide equal access to career schools. I guess I'll shift over to that. We educate on and enforce laws prohibiting unlawful discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodation in career schools, and we respond to inquiries regarding discrimination. I'd like to point out that at least when I came into the job, I think I had maybe a misperception, and I know that a lot of the public does, that we are an advocacy agency, and actually we're a neutral law enforcement agency. Only at the point where we find substantial evidence of an unlawful employment practice do we actually become an advocate for the complainant, and that's actually less than 10% of the time. So every year we receive approximately 27,000 inquiries. That could be a phone call. Most of them are phone calls. Sometimes they're walk-ins to one of our offices, or emails that are sent to the agency. And that translates into approximately between 2,000 and 2,300 complaints that are drafted, formal complaints that are drafted each year. And those complaints are distributed among 14.5 investigators. We have a half-time investigator position in Eugene. That's the 14.5 full-time equivalent. So you get an idea of the quantity of the cases, and the caseloads per investigator, they get as high as 90, which is really pretty difficult to manage, and probably the most manageable lower level is around 50 to 55. Currently, our investigators' caseloads vary because some people have been on leave from about 35 to about 75 in their caseload.
Ms. Clare, regarding your FTE, you said 14.5, so you have one person in Eugene half-time. The other 14, are they in the same office? Or
no, they're divided. We have... I could look at my thing. I think we have three in Eugene, three investigators in Eugene. We have one investigator in Pendleton, one investigator in Medford, and the rest are in Portland.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, one in Salem as well.
Okay.
I apologize for that. And we have three intake officers, and one position currently is actually we have three investigator positions that are empty as well, and we have one intake officer position that's empty. So we have only two intake officers handling those 27,000 inquiries each year. So they generally respond to anywhere from 50 to 80 phone calls a day that are sent over from the reception area so that they can screen to see if someone has potential jurisdiction of a complaint, and then they'll send out a questionnaire. And then the other part of their time is spent drafting formal charges that are sent off to the complainants.
And those vacancies are staying vacant because of the freeze on new hires?
No, we're going to fill those positions. Yeah.
Yes, some of the vacant. Unfortunately, one of the vacancies was due to the death of one of our investigators a few months ago, and we're just in the process of filling those positions.
Thank you.
Okay, so I went over the inquiries, and I also went over the cases vary, the number from about 2,100 to 2,300 per year, and 98% are related to employment. And the majority of our complaints are sex discrimination. That can also include the pregnancy pregnancy protections, pregnancy disability. What's it called? Pregnancy disability. And then disability itself, which is 20%, injured worker, which is 15%, and race and color, which is 10%. And those aren't mutually exclusive categories. Frequently, you'll see someone that has allegations regarding potential discrimination based on disability. There may be family leave issues in there and injured workers issues in there as well. We strive to complete our investigations within 180 days. By law, for most of our investigations, we have up to 365 days to complete the investigation. I'm really working with our staff to try to shorten that. We think that sooner that we can come to a conclusion and do a thorough investigation, it's better for both parties. Also, we have contracts with Oregon OSHA to investigate allegations of retaliation for reporting unsafe working conditions, and we have 90 days to complete those investigations. So those are called a priority, and that's a much more accelerated investigation. We also have contracts with city ordinances. There are cities that have ordinances that go beyond state law in a couple counties. I think at present we have Multnomah County, the City of Portland, City of Salem, City of Eugene, City of Corvallis. City of Ashland has their own ordinance, but we're no longer enforcing. They're enforcing their own. We have Benton County, and City of Bend just passed one, too. We don't enforce theirs yet. It says we will. We're working on a contract. And I believe the City of Lake Oswego and the City of Beaverton have recently passed ordinances that extend protections for under sexual orientation and gender identity. Those cases, when we have a contract, we have to complete those within 90 days. Another division goal is to conduct 40% of our interviews within the first 40 days of the filing. Generally, when an investigator gets a complaint, we send out a request for a respondent, which is generally the employer, to respond to the complaint and give us a position statement that goes over each of the allegations. And we want to have that on hand before we conduct that initial interview. And so the goal is, actually, we try to do it within 30 days, but more realistic because of the staffing shortages, is to try to complete that within 40 days. And then again, the average completion time of 180 days within 60% of the investigations. Sometimes, for instance, it's really difficult to to meet this goal of conducting that initial interview if you haven't gotten a position statement from a respondent, because that can extend it. If we do try to do the interview of a complainant without having the position statement of the respondent, then we'll have to go back and re-interview them again, and that just extends the case further. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have.
I don't think there are any.
Great.
Thank you.
And the third division, of course, is the Apprenticeship and Training Division. Steve Sims is the director of the Apprenticeship and Training Division. One other thing while he's coming up here, I might point out to you, is there's other information contained within your booklet on our strategic goals, performance measures, budget, and our legislation and an explanation of each and every bill that we have in. One other item in the back, there should be at least three of the brochures which tell all about the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we'd certainly be happy to make those available should any of the legislators need them for town hall meetings or other seminars. They may find a necessity for those out.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, committee members. My name is Stephen Sims. I'm the director of the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Division and also the secretary to the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council. I believe you have a one-page briefing document in your package today. I'm hoping to give you a bit of a deeper understanding of the apprenticeship function in the state and also update some of the figures contained in that briefing package. The statutory authority for the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council is set forth in ORS 660.110. The council is composed of the Labor Commissioner and 10 members who are appointed by the governor, subject to confirmation by the State Senate. The council is responsible for the approval and monitoring of registered apprenticeship programs in the state. Pursuant to ORS 660.170, the Apprenticeship and Training Division serves as staff to the State Apprenticeship Council for purposes of carrying out our mandate under ORS Chapter 660. The division currently operates with 17 FTE. 9 of those FTE are apprenticeship representatives, field representatives who work on a day-to-day basis with industry to develop and provide oversight to our registered apprenticeship programs. Registered apprenticeship combines supervised on-the-job training with related classroom instruction. One of the missions of the State Council and the Division is to tie together this training with nationally recognized skill standards in order to make sure the journey workers developed in the state of Oregon are competitive with journey workers throughout the country. Apprenticeship programs or committees are industry-driven and industry-motivated. Most programs start when an industry or a group of employers contact one of our offices and say, we have a need for training. And it's important to remember that apprenticeship trains for a career. We don't do vestibule training or short-term training. We prepare people for long-term careers in an occupation. When we get a request for assistance from an occupation or from an industry, one of our field representatives will meet with the industry, try to determine what those training needs are, try to categorize it with respect to the specific occupation. We will use our resources both locally, partnering with the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and with other state apprenticeship agencies to find out what educational resources are there and what the on-the-job training will look like. We then work with the industry to develop a formal committee that oversees the delivery of that training throughout the state. Once we've developed the training delivery package, we present the package along with an overview of how that organization, that apprenticeship program, will operate to the State Apprenticeship Council for approval. Apprenticeship programs are operated by joint labor management partnerships. One of the goals of the council and the division is to ensure that apprenticeship programs are operated in compliance with state and federal laws and regulations that and ensure that those programs provide fair and equal opportunity for training to all Oregonians. again, as registered apprenticeship is industry driven. Our numbers go up and down based upon how well the economy is doing. I think in the late 1990s we had slightly fewer than 9,000 apprentices. As of December 31st, 2004, we have 5,493 active registered apprentices in the state, up 2% from the prior year. During calendar year 2004, 1,934 new apprentices were registered with the state. During 2004, 1,092 individuals completed their apprenticeship programs and received journey-level certificates. Approximately 77% of all apprentices are in the building and construction trades, another 18% are in the manufacturing occupations, and 5% of our registrations are in service industries, primarily corrections, security guards, and the like. We currently have 156 active apprenticeship committees in the state, training in 59 different occupations. Another important role of the council in the division is to ensure that registered apprenticeship programs operate in conformity with all applicable equal employment regulations and laws. In calendar year 2004, the division conducted and the State Apprenticeship Council reviewed affirmative action EEO reviews for each of the 156 registered programs in the state. At the conclusion of 2004, 12.8% of all registered apprentices were members of ethnic minority groups, and 5.1% of all apprentices were women. The council and the division fully recognizes the importance of increasing the number of women and minorities in the trades and has established goals for increasing female registration to 6% and minority registration to 14% during calendar year 2005. The division also conducts program operations reviews of its registered programs. Programs that have previously been found in compliance for 2 years in a row are reviewed for programs operation once every 3 years. New programs and programs that have not been found in compliance are reviewed annually until they can be found in compliance for two consecutive years. Under a contract between the Bureau and the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, the division provides specialized assistance to qualified veterans seeking to enter apprenticeship programs. The division also develops on-the-job training programs for employers who agree to hire qualified veterans. During the upcoming biennium, the council and the division will continue to coordinate with the Oregon Department of Transportation to maximize the training and diversity opportunities made available through the OTIA 3 bridge replacement project. The division has also entered into strategic partnerships with the City of Portland, TriMet, PDC, and other government agencies to maximize the utilization of registered apprentices on public works projects. Finally, the division hopes to increase its efforts to bring registered apprenticeship in more closely with the state education and workforce system. We want to make sure that there's a continuum between high school and registered apprenticeship and that people know that these opportunities are available. We are going to attempt to develop two pilot projects where high school students can receive accredited vocational education training in the private industry-operated apprenticeship training centers throughout the state. We also hope to develop a comprehensive program to educate and engage guidance counselors and educators about the types of career opportunities available in the apprenticeship trades, and we also hope to obtain continuing education credit for instructors who would enroll in this program. That completes my overview of the apprenticeship division, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Sims, could you give us a little bit more information as to this these new projects as it pertains back to the high school? How are you going to integrate that into the schools and get that information out so young people know those opportunities are there?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Right now, we are working with OPTE, the Office of Professional Technical Education. They already have some level of vocational education coordination in the school system. Unfortunately, many of the voc ed centers in various school districts have been closed due to budget cuts and for other reasons. What we hope to do is to use them to determine who already has an established program, what districts have programs available, and what they are lacking. We then hope to go to some of our private industry training centers in those areas where there's a severe need and ask them if they can provide the same level of education. We would then work with, we'd have OPTE, the school district, and the apprenticeship training center in that area try to develop a curriculum for these students that would qualify for high school credits. We don't want to take them out of that normal path, but it would also articulate with the first year entry level curriculum for the apprenticeship program, thus giving the student a win, i.e. they get extra credit, and secondly giving industry a win. They get to have someone who is, I won't say pre-trained, but at least has a much better chance of understanding what's required in that particular occupation. Our hope, and I'm being optimistic, I guess, but I hope that we can have at least one program up and running by September, hopefully by the start of the second half of the school year in December of 06, we could have the other program up and running. We're looking at one pilot program in an urban area, the other in a rural area.
Great. Thank you for the clarification.
Certainly.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If there's no other questions, that really concludes our presentation.
Commissioner, thank you very much for sharing this time with us and giving us an overview. It sounds like the department is definitely involved in some excellent programs, and I hope that they come forward and go forward, and especially with the apprentice. I think that's one of those areas that, knowing what's, as we've heard, the impact we've had in high school, some way that we can reconnect young people to the trades.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's clearly one of our goals, and we're going to continue to work on that one.
I'm going to go ahead and close on the informational hearing we have. And what we're going to do is I'm going to go work back up the agenda. So I'm going to start with Senate Bill 172. So we're going to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 172. And we'll wait for that sheet to get here. Just for clarification, this is just opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 172. And John, I've got you on here. And then it, just to make clarification, I have, is it Ed Johnston?
Thank you.
He just walked out.
Okay. Well, John, why don't you come on up and get started? And I was just going to get clarification as to his position and see if we can bring them up together. But.
Oh.
And, yes, I think it's time for our committee administrator to give us the good word, so I won't get hit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 172, and this is basically a technical cleanup bill for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'll let them describe the bill to us.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here. My name is John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm here today to request your support of Senate Bill 172. We are not aware of any opposition to any of the provisions in this bill as I entered today. The bill basically addresses three technical aspects of workers' compensation law. Namely, the first is a change, an amendment to the statute to shorten the time frames that would trigger a reconsideration of a notice of closure. The second is to eliminate the need for a duplicative statutory requirement in the division's administrative rules. And then three is to repeal what we think is an obsolete statute relating to pre-employment screening. To the first point in regard to reconsiderations of notices of closure, when a workers' compensation claim is closed, a notice of closure is completed by the insurer or self-insured employer and mailed to the worker. when the insurer or self-insured employer requests reconsideration of their notice of closure or actually files an appeal on their notice of closure, the reconsideration process begins when the later of the following three things happen. Number one, the worker requests reconsideration themselves. In other words, there's a cross request. Both the insurer and the worker are requesting reconsideration. Two, the worker waives the right to request reconsideration. Or three, the time within which reconsideration can be requested expires. And again, I repeat, it's the later of those three things under the law actually triggers when the reconsideration process for that notice of closure can begin. So in all cases where an insurer or self-insured employer requests reconsideration, the 60 days allowed by the statute to request reconsideration is going to be the last event. Senate Bill 172 proposes to change the triggering event from the later of the three events to the earliest of the three events. So if the worker requested reconsideration, the process of reconsideration could begin at that time, since you've got a cross request from both parties. Or if the worker waives their right to request reconsideration. Or if the earliest event is that the time has expired, the 60 days has expired, then that would trigger the reconsideration process at that time. The next section grants authority for the director to issue civil penalties for violation of a statute under the workers' compensation law. Currently, the law basically allows the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to assess a civil penalty when an employer or an insurer fails to comply with rules and orders of the director. It does not allow the current law does not allow the director to issue a civil penalty for violation of statute. What we are asking for in this bill is to modify the statute to grant this authority to allow the department to streamline its administrative rules. In practice, what's happening is that in areas where we find where violations of statutes occur often enough that we would be concerned about needing the authority to assess a civil penalty, we're repeating the statute in our administrative rules. Therefore, we have the authority then to issue a civil penalty. We feel that this would streamline our administrative rules, make them shorter, without losing any real enforcement authority. The third part of this bill would delete or actually eliminate ORS 656.806, which is a part of the statute which allows pre-employment screening of prospective employees by a physician designated by the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This bill would eliminate this provision. To the best of our knowledge, this provision has never been used. It certainly has never been used since I've been at the department. We went back to and looked at legislative history to try to find what was the point or the purpose of this provision. We do, and there is some, in your written testimony, there is some information about that. It appears that the statute that authorized an establishment of a physician list that the director would choose from, in terms of pre-employment physicals, that list was eliminated or repealed itself in 1973. So as far as we can see, we have no list from which to designate a physician to provide the examination, and we think this is an obsolete provision of the law. So basically, this bill's purpose is to streamline three parts of the law or processes or obsolete provisions, and we respectfully request the committee's support for SB 172, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I could.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
John, did them lack the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has reviewed this bill and has approved it to go forward to the legislature.
Any other questions? John, thank you very much. And
you're welcome.
Let's see, Mr. Johnston, are you back? Mr. Johnston. You're signed up for both bills, but didn't say position, so we weren't sure, but please come up. We're on Senate Bill 172.
Yeah, that's correct. My name is Johnson. I didn't have a chance to totally read all the bill. I agree with part of it, but the one thing I got to say, dealing with 60 days with the employer, as speaking as an injured worker, still fighting to keep my life, still fighting the insurance company, the whole structure. The insurance company deliberately tried to kill me, in my opinion, when I didn't have surgery, when I had a broken neck for 5 years, crawling around on my belly. Plus, 2.5 years ago to a year and a half ago, I was taking Vioxx and all the naproxen and all the stuff that now you have heart attacks and strokes, which at that point I did have a stroke and a slight heart attack, but the doctors didn't want to deal with it because of the medication when they realized what it was. It's not the doctor's fault they're in this position of pushing medication out. So I don't blame the doctors. I blame the agencies that are involved overlooking that and the companies themselves. The one question I have, or I haven't had a chance to really go through this, do a real opinion on and have it to this committee shortly, but the 60 days for the worker, I think that should be expanded to 1 year because it sort of goes against the Oregon State Constitution of life and liberty. It depends on the way you read the Constitution or the way you look at it. But the workers are not usually told their options by the attorneys or by the agency, so I think because the workers have to educate themselves, I think the one-year statute gives the time for the worker to defend themselves on injury. I do know half of my neck is titanium. I have 7 blown discs. I have all the medical records and everything to prove it except for the MRIs and x-rays because the workman's comp company I was dealing with, Liberty Northwest, destroyed all the evidence. By law, I had to give them even my copies that I had when they already destroyed all the originals. Okay, and when I was forced by my attorney to give my copy to the insurance company. Now, those have been destroyed, so the insurance company's already been getting away with enough as it is.
Yeah.
I'm not going against this bill,
okay,
but I think that there could be a couple of reprovisions like the 1 year and a couple other things. And dealing with eliminating the, I'm not quite sure, maybe I'm speaking off record on this one, but eliminating the physical exam for doctors. Maybe I'm misquoting that, but when it comes to dealing with law enforcement and that stuff, I don't think that should be eliminated. Maybe I'm misreading that because I haven't had a chance to go through it and analyze that part. But if that's going to eliminate for their exams and stuff, we don't need that. And so that's where I'm coming from on that. We need to be cautious of what we're doing to not only protect the workers out there, but we are the workers ourselves sitting in this room. So we have to protect ourselves as well. So I think the 1 year would actually work real well. I'm not going against the bill. It just maybe a couple things need to be adjusted. But I believe part of it's on the right track. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Johnston? All right. Is there anyone else in the room that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 172? Not seeing anyone. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 172 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 172.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 172 to the floor with the due path recommendation.
Mr. Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 172 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion between the committee members? Is there any objection from any of the committee members? If not, we'll move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation for Senate Bill 172 and carry her. Okay. Let's see. Since you made the motion, we'll let Senator Burdick carry this one. How's that?
I owe the committee, Mr. Chair. I've carried my bill the other day.
Okay. And at this time, we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. And we have 3 people signed up to testify. Mr. Stiltz, if you'll come back up. And is it Ted Swigger?
Yes.
Swigert, excuse me. Both of you are signed up for a position of supporting the bill. I'm going to let you two go first, and then Mr. Johnston's on the schedule. We'll let him go next. And if we can have an overview from our trustee administrator. Ah, I caught you that one, didn't I? I thought I was going to take a little longer. I'm learning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 119 authorizes the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to provide reemployment assistance from the Worker Benefit Fund to eligible workers and their employers. It requires notice of assistance to workers.
Thank you. Who would like to start off?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to start, if I may, again, for the record. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I appear today to request the committee's support for this bill, although I do want to state up front there is an amendment that is pending on this bill in legislative council. The purpose of the bill is to increase the use of return-to-work programs. Most injured workers who have residual permanent disability are not eligible for traditional vocational rehabilitation or retraining services within the workers' compensation system. Since 1998, the number of workers eligible for the traditional vocational rehabilitation has fluctuated between about 714 to about 765. A much larger number of workers become eligible for what's known as the Preferred Worker Program and Preferred Worker Benefits. In fact, there were over 2,100 workers eligible for this program in fiscal year 2004. So I want to give just a little bit of background about what the Preferred Worker Program is. The Preferred Worker Program basically consists of a package of incentives that workers can use to help themselves find employment with Oregon employers. The Preferred Worker Program allows workers to offer employers an exemption from paying workers' compensation premium for 3 years. There's claims cost reimbursement out of the worker benefit fund if the worker has a new injury within that 3-year premium exemption period. They are eligible for up to 50% of a wage subsidy. A subsidy of 50% of their wages, I think would be the more correct way to put that, for the first 6 months of employment. And they're also eligible for necessary tools, training, or worksite modifications to help the worker perform the job within their physical capacities. Now, the Preferred Worker Program can be a key to getting the worker back on the job, and both employers and workers receive benefits from this program. Our data shows, and we've been conducting studies about the Preferred Worker Program, our data shows that workers who use the Preferred Worker Program are very successful in not only returning to work, but in recapturing their wages. For example, our studies show that 13 quarters after their injury, so we're talking about over 3 years after the injury, a preferred worker who uses their benefits were 20% more likely to be employed than a preferred worker who didn't use the benefits. And they were employed at wages that were 17% higher than preferred workers who did not use their benefits. So there was a substantial difference in that population alone. Unfortunately, during recent years, program use is declining. In the years 2000 and 2001, for workers who were injured in those years, only 23% of the eligible workers used the program. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has, in the interim, made some substantive recommendations regarding return-to-work programs, and this bill is a result of some of those recommendations. Currently, the statute does not allow the department to make expenditures to assist preferred workers in finding employment. The worker must not only sell the program, but they need to sell themselves to employers. The Workers' Compensation Division conducted another study of injured workers to ask the workers what they felt they needed most in terms of help in getting back to work. And two of the top three responses were help in deciding what sort of work to pursue and help in finding a job. Use of the Preferred Worker Program to promote job placement can be done to provide workers with such things as an appropriate selection of employment to seek, learning how to seek a job itself or job seeking skills, placement assistance, resume writing, and those sorts of things. Passage of this bill would provide a means for workers to get this help. In addition, we were advised by the Department of Justice that some traditional purchases that we have been making for, frankly, 14 years in the Preferred Worker Program since it was started out of the Mahonia Hall reforms, such things as buying the workers specialized tools that would be required by employers, providing workers with moving expenses so they can relocate for a job that they have been able to obtain through the Preferred Worker Program, or providing workers with adequate clothing. Let's say a worker is coming in from the warehouse and into the front office and maybe needs to wear a tie and a sport coat, doesn't own that. We've provided those sorts of clothes. The Department of Justice advised us in this last interim that the statute really isn't clear that we can provide those sorts of assistance. So their advice was to clarify that in the statute. This bill would make clear that purchases made for workers to assist them in their employment through the Preferred Worker Program would be authorized in the statute. This also provides, by defining what a preferred worker is, it promotes the use of the Preferred Worker Program even if the worker is not yet medically stationary, but where it's clear that the worker is going to have permanent disability. So it promotes an earlier use of the Preferred Worker Program. We don't have to wait until the worker gets their notice of closure when everybody knows that the worker is going to have permanent disability. We can start them back to work and allow the employer to access Preferred Worker Program benefits early to help get that worker back to work in a regular full-time job.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Is that the effect of moving this definition down in this section so it'll apply to the whole section? Is that how you accomplish that? Because I was a little puzzled by the deletion of the definition from one part of the section and moving it down lower. And you did it so that it would make it apply sooner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, that's my understanding of the effect of that. It clarifies that we are able to provide preferred worker benefits to the worker who's unable to return to work in their regular employment, whether or not the notice of closure has been issued.
Yeah. Okay, because it applies to the whole section.
Yeah.
Yes.
To
the subsection. Thank you.
Overall, this bill is not going to result in more injured workers being eligible for the Preferred Worker Program. What this bill is going to do, it's going to increase the number of workers who can use the Preferred Worker Program to achieve gainful employment. And we know this is a program that works. Now to the amendment, and I apologize that the amendment isn't here before you. That would have been the best thing. We've requested an amendment to this bill. It's currently in Legislative Council, and it includes another concept that was developed through the MLAC process after the original bill was drafted. The amendment goes to an issue that is in regard to the vocational assistance or the traditional vocational rehabilitation or retraining program itself, not the Preferred Worker Program. Under current law, when the insurer determines that an injured worker is not eligible for vocational assistance services, and the worker appeals that decision, and administrative review is undertaken by the department. If that administrative review overturns the insurer's decision, the insurer can stay or stop most vocational assistance services until the appeals are exhausted or the order becomes final. The stay of those benefits can last several months. In fact, can last a couple of years. The amendment that we have will allow vocational assistance to proceed. In other words, it will allow the worker to receive their vocational assistance benefits. However, if the department's decision ordering vocational assistance benefits is overturned, the concept in the amendment is that the costs for the vocational assistance that have been provided to the worker and paid for by the insurer would be reimbursed from the worker benefit fund. So in other words, if the insurer ultimately prevails on the appeal, they would be reimbursed for their costs.
At no cost to the injured worker, but from the fund.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. At no cost other than what we all pay into the worker benefit fund. And I do want to point out that there's just a slight handful of cases, less than 10 cases a year, where the department's administrative order is ultimately overturned in favor of the insurer. So we're looking at a pretty small chance that we're going to see many of those orders overturned. So at this time, we would request that the committee hold this bill until the proposed amendment is ready for reconsideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions that I can at this time.
All right. First, house cleaning. On these types of situations, my understanding from speaking to our committee administrator, we didn't have notice that there was going to be an amendment coming. I think for just our work process, it'd be nice in the future if the department finds themselves bringing amendments. One, if they're ready, of course, we want to get them as soon as we can so we can make certain everyone in the committee has knowledge of that. If they're not ready, if we don't know that too, that way we can schedule appropriately and we're not necessarily going to tie up time for everyone, because at this point we will want you to come back and have to reschedule it for another public hearing on that part to give everyone the opportunity to respond who may in fact want to have some say on that. With that said, are there any questions at this point? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, what's the health of the worker benefit fund? Is it healthy as far as financial health?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, the worker benefit fund is healthy. In fact, most recently we were able to lower the assessment on that, and it's doing very well.
Follow up?
No pun intended. There's being doing well.
Go right ahead.
Excuse me.
Was it the worker benefit fund that was actually had some money taken out of it last session to balance the budget, or is that the other fund that we pay into as the insurers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe you're probably referring to there was somewhere between $15 and $20 million that was taken out at the end of the session for balancing, and that was taken from the premium assessment operating account, our other operational fund.
So this bill is not going to jeopardize the integrity of the fund if more people are being serviced by the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, no, we don't think so. We have analyzed that, and this bill will result, we think, in more people accessing services, which means there would be more expenditures out of the worker benefit fund. We do not think that that will adversely affect our fund balance, though.
Could I just follow up on Senator Beyer's question? It seems to me that y'all have
had some experiences to individual workers who currently do not qualify that may in fact qualify in the future if this law goes, if this bill goes forward. Can you give us some type of numbers? I know just in raw numbers of people, not necessarily the amount that would be paid out to assist those individuals.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We did make some estimates of that, and if you'll bear with me, I'll track down and I believe we thought that there was somewhere in the neighborhood of anywhere from 150 to 300 workers that would likely access preferred worker program benefits in addition to what we're seeing today.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, John. Ms. Swigert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ted Swigert. I am the field services manager for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, which is a program of the Department of Human Services. I'm here today in support of this Senate bill in that I guess I just want to update you in terms of what we've been doing with the reemployment unit, which is part of the Workers' Compensation Division. We've been doing some planning actually over the last year and a half now, trying to come up with ideas where we could work together to do some outreach and providing services to people who are eligible for the preferred worker benefit but who have not been taking advantage of it. And one of the, actually we've done quite a bit of work, quite a bit of planning around it, and brought, got to the point where we brought line staff together, and when we were done with that meeting, I have to tell you that I was very excited about kind of what we had discovered in terms of ways that we could work together in a concerted effort to help people that have this benefit to utilize the benefit. But there was a, we found out there was a complication in terms of what the reemployment unit could do in, to contract with us to provide this service. The service itself, or the services that I'm talking about, are really above and beyond what vocational rehabilitation does because it involves outreach. It also involves some expedited services. So it would be a specialized service, but what we think and what we would hope would happen is by working together we can, number one, contact the individuals who have the benefit, two, provide them with some counseling and rehabilitation services, and three, help them get employed in a much expedited way. And so it's been an area that we've worked on and feel very positive about, and Senate Bill 119 would support that.
Great. Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Swigert? All right. Thank you very much.
Just one more comment, if I may, Mr. Chair. I did hear your, most definitely heard your comment on getting amendments to the committee, and I apologize that wasn't done today, and hopefully that won't happen in the future.
I appreciate that. On following up on the amendment, do you have any time frame as from LC when that might be ready?
Mr. Chair, I was told that it is likely to come out after the House deadline for new bills is passed.
Deadline for new bills, so that means Monday is when they're supposed to have their, so okay,
sometime after that date.
As soon as it is, please let us know or get it to Ms. Braun before we can go ahead and get this going. I want to start clearing some of our workload. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
All right. And Mr. Johnson, you're scheduled to have written down that you'd like to give testimony on Senate Bill 119. Please come up and...
Yes. My name is Ed Johnson. I sort of have quite a bit of personal experience with this type of stuff. Back in 1989, when I became a disabled worker, getting my neck broken on the job, I went through the x-rays, fought them, getting x-rays. What bothers me, let me get into this little scenario here. 1992, I was classified as totally disabled by the insurance company, waiting for surgery. The next thing you know, I get things filed on me, tells me, well, I'm capable to go back to work with a broken neck. I got hernia discs in my spinal cord. So I'm told I'm going back to work. Well, the preferred worker program is what I'm going through. All right. When we eliminated general assistance in this state, that was one of the things that disabled workers had to fall back on. All right, because you don't get unemployment, and insurance companies say we aren't going to pay you until you take us to court or administrative court, which I think the one thing that needs to be amended in this thing is, beside administrative law judges, should be courts too. because this is a constitutional state. We do have a constitution that the courts, constitutional courts, need to hear this as well, and it should be up to the injured worker. $500 limitation to me is very steep when they write, when an injured worker, like in my position, when I got became disabled, they knew that I was disabled, and basically they were waiting for me to die is what it comes down to, but they were able to write off so much against that. $500 to me should be at least doubled when it comes down to that. The worker needs the opportunity to have the money to be able to go back to work. I was one of those that was forced by this program to go back to work by the insurance company with a broken neck. Disc went in my spinal cord. It was literally killing me. The x-rays and MRIs proved it. Okay? I spent 5 years taking all 500 pain pills per month, drinking a pint of whiskey per day just to work in the pain I was in, just to get me through the day so that way I could still work. Okay? With a broken neck, with a disc in my spinal cord.
Mr. Johnson,
so this has a lot. Go ahead.
I was going to ask you regarding the bill that we have before, Senate Bill 119. I don't know if you had an opportunity to review it.
Not all of it. I'm just bringing up a couple points on testimony so this way you understand how part of this could be manipulated by the insurance companies. So this is the one thing that needs to be aware about these things. So there needs to be some provision to at least have the worker mm-hmm. to be able to defend himself.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Based on the testimony we've heard from the two previous witnesses, basically this bill, if it goes forward, would actually allow more individuals to actually participate in the preferred worker program before they're able to actually, let's say, get to the point of knowing that they're regularly, let's say, they're going to be permanently disabled.
Right, I'm not disputing.
So do you think that's is a good thing to have it apply for?
Well, I'm not disagreeing with the director administration of it. That is a possible good thing, but what frustrates me about it is how it can be misimplied and misused by the insurance company, as I've literally lived through it. I have all the records and testimonies to prove that. As far as testimony on that 2 years ago, because I know what it's like being in so much pain where you put a gun to your head to blow your head off and you miss your head and you blow a hole in your house and you have to go figure out if you shot a neighbor by accident, panicking over that because you can't move and your neck's so red because of blood in your spinal cord. So I know what all that's about. So what I'm not disagreeing with that point, but is it possible of the abuse that this bill leaves too far open for that by saying that if we're going to leave this opportunity as what I lived through, this program put me right back out in the workforce when I should have been waiting, as my surgeons at the time said, wait a couple of years until the procedures work so we get your neck fixed. I was forced to go back to work and basically injured my spinal cord even worse, where I was permanent spinal cord damage, nerve damage. I'm still fighting the system over this thing. I still haven't been compensated for anything.
Right.
So this is what scares me about part of opening that door further.
Yeah.
But there needs to be an understanding that that door is not to be opened in that manner. The bill in that intent has the right intention. I'm not going against that.
All right.
But what I'm saying is it leaves a door open that we need to make sure there's a provision so the insurance companies cannot take advantage of that door to go against the worker for their own personal financial gain.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Anyone else here in the room that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 119? If not, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 119. And is there any other business for us or announcements or anything we need to go over?
I thought we would mention the travel meeting, but that's fine.
You can mention it to me.
You can tell both of us. We'll let Sheriff, please.
We have four members that have confirmed on their traveling March 10th. Senator Beyer, Senator Ringo, yourself, and Senator Whitson. So.
All right, so we're working for Senator Burdick?
Yes.
All right, well, tag teamer. Well, that will close the hearing today for, or I should say, the committee on Senate Commerce. Thank you.
Manager.